Hello and welcome to 1865 Inside the Episode. This is Rob McCollum, one of the producers on 1865, and joining me for this final Inside the Episode, Eric Archilla and Steve Walters.
Hello, Rob.
Woo! Welcome back. I say back because we recorded a majority of these Inside the Episodes many, many months ago when we were finishing up the actual episodes themselves, and now we took some time away. They have now gone live. People have been listening. We've been getting feedback and getting to hear them out in the world. So it's kind of nice to come back and have a little perspective on this thing as a not a potential thing, but an actual thing. Did you guys ever think we were going to get to this point?
No.
No.
I still don't believe it.
But workaholic me is like, where do we go next?
Yes.
What do we do? We spend our time.
I'm not ready to answer that question, Eric. But speaking of the time, before we dive into this final bonus episode that hopefully everyone has just heard, and as always, I will say, if you have not listened to episode 16, do so now. There will be spoilers. Listen to that first, then come back to us, and we will dive into that final episode in just a minute. But big picture, let's talk about what it took to get there in the recording process to this final episode, and also to get here to this point when it is out and live and in the world. It's been a long time. What is the total time you would say since you started? It was 14 years ago? Is that right?
2002 is really when we started. 2003 was when we read for the reading at the end of the year.
So that's like 17 years.
A long time. But almost none of the original play Booth made its way into the podcast. I think almost nothing.
I think the only scene that is close is the Hail, You're Not to Date My Daughter scene.
Although
I think that's one of the only that's even remotely has anything.
I think you're right. I think that might have been the only one, which is bizarre to think about.
Well, we've gotten here now. I guess let's start talking about the episode that we have just heard, which I love that it is the final thing that we are hearing because it brings us full circle with our bonus episodes up into the last moment before the entire series begins. So talk about where we find John Wilkes Booth and Lucy at the very beginning of this episode.
Okay, so his kidnapping plot has failed. And this was his chance to go after the president. This is when John Surratt and a lot of the conspirators back out. And actually, we have documentation of Samuel Arnold and Michael O'Loughlin, our composite character, them backing out and saying, we're out. We want no longer to be a part of this because the planning was poor. And Surratt, as we assume, now that they've been seen in public together, probably not a good idea for them to continue this group. And so everything falls apart and John's left by himself. And and then, as we'll see in the final episode, things grow more desperate as the South is slowly losing its ground and growing closer to defeat.
Yeah, the cause is dying as he sees it, as well as his stature within the CSS. He's kind of in, but not really legitimate in, and seems like he's really seeking that legitimacy. Is that purely a artistic license that you guys took, or is that based on some research.
That's based on all the research we've done. It seems like he was not a full-fledged member, but he was seeking recognition from them and money from them. And Surratt, again, is the tie to the CSS for him. And without Surratt now he's got to take matters into his own hands.
And this is really the episode where we see him take that last step towards radicalization, to take that last step towards truly becoming and fulfilling his monstrous destiny that, of course, precipitates the entire first 13 episodes of our series.
And the event that does precipitate that most historians tend to agree with is hearing Lincoln's last speech, where Lincoln has the audacity to talk about suffrage and allowing freedmen to vote.
And there are multiple accounts of Booth saying after he heard the speech, by God, that is the last speech that man will ever make. It's also worth noting for the fans of the show or the folks who have listened up until this point, there was someone else in our show who was in the audience that day, in the crowd that day, and that was John Mercer Langston. He was standing not too far away from John Wilkes Booth when Lincoln made that comment. And of course, there's a reference to that in the first Langston scene in the play, which actually ended up getting cut, but in on the cutting room floor, it went away. But originally it said, I had such high hopes having heard his last speech when he made the appeals for citizenship and equality. And then now this horrific occurrence has happened. It's just interesting that they were both there at the same time.
Because that was the first time that Lincoln had ever mentioned suffrage. And then he died 4 days later.
So there were several things that I really liked about this episode. Some of them were that there were scenes we had heard the other side of. A little bit later, the final exchange between Booth and Lucy that Robert walked in on the episode, kind of about Robert's POV of that, or point of ear on that. We hear that now from Booth and Lucy's standpoint. And then they're also, when they're in the barn and being called by the soldiers to come out, and then their bodies are brought out, we hear kind of the aftermath of that moment that we heard just a snippet of before. So I like these things that reference back to themselves.
Yeah, and hopefully that will encourage you to go back and listen to the whole thing again.
Well, and I guess it is a little bit of artistic license that Robert and Booth both saw each other or ran into each other with Lucy present. But we do know that Lucy and Robert presumably had a Spanish lesson that day, I believe.
Yes.
And we allegedly, it's been said that John Wilkes Booth's final words to Lucy were the, you know, line from Hamlet, where Hamlet says to Ophelia, "Nymph, and thy orisons be all my sins remembered." And that's allegedly what he said to her on that day. So we sort of just took the license of combining those two sort of factoids.
And also it is said that Robert was originally supposed to go to the ford with his father, and then he backed out. So we were trying to put those issues together and dramatize
all those together.
Yeah.
Right. So what are some other things that happened in this episode that you think we should flesh out a little bit? One thing that we skip entirely
is the journey that Booth goes on in those 12 days before he dies. And a couple of the scenes that ended up on the cutting room floor were scenes of him on the manhunt, which we originally had in the play.
While they were in pursuit.
While they were being pursued. First thing he does is he goes to the Surratt Tavern and he asks for the guns. This is one of the things that gets Mary hung eventually, because she's the one that rode over there that morning. Her son brought the gun several days earlier, and then she showed up that morning with a bag with field glasses and said, "Have the guns ready." And
well, allegedly. I mean, of course, there are many people that believe she did not say that, and that this Mr. Lloyd person who
was renting
worked
the
for her, and renting the tavern, that he made that up because they were putting pressure on him. So it's a little bit unclear where the truth lies as it relates to the guns. But it is, yes, and that is the thing that really pushed it over the edge. That's the first place he went, and then where did he go from there?
He went to Dr. Mudd's to get his legs set. The broken leg is really what did him in, because the description that these two men were on the run, one had a broken leg, is the thing that damned him.
Yeah, made it really clear who these two guys might be.
So he broke his leg, of course,
after he shouted out Sic Semper Tyrannis. He leapt off the balcony, and when he landed on the stage, he broke his leg and hobbled off into the alley out back.
I know we talked earlier in one of the early episodes that Stanton was asking for a huge bounty for information leading to. Did that get collected? Did people provide that information? And did that ever pay out?
Well, the way it really paid off is that all of these soldiers joined in this manhunt because they all wanted to cash in on the bounty. And so there was a massive manhunt for him.
It was, at the time, the largest manhunt in United States history.
Yes. And so everybody was looking for him. And he probably would have stayed at Mudd's house longer, but Mudd went into town, heard what he had done, allegedly, and he wanted Booth out of there, kicked Booth out. Booth fled from Mudd's, leaving a boot that had JWB in it under the bed from where he had doctored his leg, which is what ended up damning Dr. Mudd. Next place he went was Colonel Samuel Cox, who hid him in the forest for 5 days. And then they tried to cross the Potomac. They ended up going the wrong way and landed back in Maryland instead of Virginia, crossed over. And then he found that people were very unsympathetic to him and were unwilling to help him. And so it was kind of, when he was in that 5-day forest stay, he was seeing newspapers and things did not go the way he planned. He was expecting to be a hero.
He thought he was going to be a hero, yeah.
And so the bounty didn't necessarily help out in his capture. It was more the public turn against him that stopped people from helping him. And then he ended up at the Garrett farm. And then we lead up to that last moment where Booth is shot in the barn by Corbet, who we talked about, crazy Boston Corbet. And then they drag him out to the porch, and he's dying, and he utters those last words, which are
useless, useless.
And some people now insinuate maybe he said Lucy, Lucy, and they misheard him. But I think since they were talking about lifting his hands and his arms not working, that it was probably useless.
And then talk about the final monologue that we hear in the podcast, which is, I think, from his journal.
It is from his journal. I believe it's his last journal entry. You know, and I think it's John Wilkes Booth at his lowest moment. It's when he realized that, you know, whatever sort of grandeur he thought he would achieve, whatever sort of status he thought he would achieve, it had all fallen apart and he was alone. And in the original version of the play, that was a moment of self-reflection for Edwin Stanton, because it was Stanton that sort of discovered Booth's journal and read those words and kind of saw little bits and pieces of himself inside of Booth's words. You know, sort of the idea was that Booth doing what he did and Stanton's desire for vengeance had kind of pushed him over the edge to become a monster. Now, in the podcast, we don't have that theatrical experience, but I think that those ideas are still at play. And if you are so inclined, listening back through what Edwin Stanton's journey is right on the heels of episode 16, I think you might see some of that a little bit more presently.
Yeah, we had actually talked about whether or not these bonus episodes, the conspirators episodes, should go at the beginning.
Yep.
Should they go in the middle?
Underneath it?
Yeah, somehow spread out through. And I'm actually really happy that we ended with the idea of let's tell Stanton's journey all the way through and then step aside and do the conspirators, because it is kind of a separate but related story. And of course, Booth at that time thinks that not only is his journey ended, but that the cause is completely lost and that all of the things he was hoping to achieve in the South would be lost. And then it turned out that those changes that he was so afraid of did not happen, that the forces that motivated him also motivated a whole lot of other people. It's interesting that we've had so much monument talk in recent times here, but especially in Texas, we've been having a lot, but all across the country. But clearly a lot of the things that happened in the Confederacy remained a lot longer than Booth feared.
Yeah, if he did not get any personal gain from what he did, he certainly served the cause of protecting the way he viewed the South from Stanton's vision of the
South. And the way he viewed the institution of slavery. It's interesting that the bulk of Confederate monuments in our country were erected in the late 19th century, and then there was another sort of like influx
in the 1920s.
In the 1920s, 30s. And then again in the 1960s during the Civil Rights era. So it's interesting that at those three very specific inflection points, that's the moment where we start to see a rise in these monuments being erected. And of course, and in the late 20s leading into the 30s, you have a rise of populism and nationalism in the United States. And of course, in Europe, which of course leads to beyond right. the Kaiser, Adolf Hitler. But you see that reflected at that time and that place and in each of those moments of inflection.
And so when we're talking about the Confederate statues going up, we also have in the 1920s and 30s when they're raising all these statues, the naming of schools after Confederate generals. I myself went to Robert E. Lee High School, and the mascot was the Rebels. And it's just so preposterous to me that we, as a country, allowed the honoring of people who committed treason against our country. And now, thankfully, there's a big push to change a lot of those school names and to take down statues that were honoring these people. That's my personal opinion, because they weren't historical things. They weren't put there in the time as history. It was put afterward for people that were trying to change the narrative of what happened and to romanticize the South and honor these people who'd committed treason.
And I went to Southwest High School in Fort Worth, and we were the Rebels as well up until the point that we changed our mascot to the Raiders, which isn't too much better, but I guess it's an improvement.
They did the same with us.
Are you serious?
We were the Red Raiders.
Wow, that is insane. Yeah. Well, the reason that ours eventually changed is because the people of color at our school had enough one day. And there was an incident when somebody had put a rebel flag up on the projection screen. So the lore goes, I wasn't there. It was before my time, but that resulted in a violent altercation. And so it was changed. But see, I actually, even the lore I question. I wonder if it was violent at all, you know?
Or if that's just the way it's been
told. That's the way it's been told. Yeah. By the powers that be that want it to be told that way.
Again, you know? as this has all highlighted, I think the stories that get told are often far more powerful than the reality of what happened in any given situation.
And it's sad that we get accused of trying to change history now when the entire reason that these statues are up was an effort to change history. But there is this big push to change the narrative of what the war was about. People often say, or there's always the question of, was the Civil War about slavery? And in my research, personally, I've come to the opinion that the Civil War was not about slavery for the North. The North drug their feet for a long time. When the South left, it was all about unifying the country. It was about bringing the South back in. They weren't fighting to eradicate slavery at the time. It really wasn't until Stanton pushed and pushed and pushed that I believe that Lincoln finally did the Emancipation Proclamation and made it about slavery. And that's what John Mercer Langston and Frederick Douglass and a lot of the abolitionists were begging Lincoln to do, was make this a righteous war, make this about slavery. And then finally he came around, and that's when we see the turn of the tide in the war, and allowing armed slaves and freedmen to fight on the side of the North. And so we have that big push of extra soldiers and having that righteousness behind them. For the South, it was wholeheartedly about slavery. And I think that the narrative that it was about states' rights. Yes, it was about states' rights, but it was the right for states to own people. And any detraction from that is an effort to gloss over antebellum South and the Lost Cause. And
yeah, to obfuscate what it was really about.
On this question of Lincoln's journey and his change in his position, his public position about slavery, there's a lot of debate about that. There are a lot of Lincoln apologists out there that would say, well, Lincoln, in his heart of hearts, was always an abolitionist. He was always vehemently anti-slavery, but he had to play the public part of a pragmatic politician. He understood that change had to come incrementally, and that if you tried to rip the Band-Aid off, that there would be no union. But the same thing, it's interesting, I think, could be said of George Washington and the Founding Fathers in the late 1780s, when the Constitutional Convention met in Philadelphia. They made the controversial decision to sideline the issue of slavery altogether, that they would not debate it until 1808. Well, the same thing could be said. If they had pushed too hard in one direction, perhaps there would be no union. Perhaps there would never have been a United States Constitution or an American president.
But the other side of that question is, if they had dealt with it in that time, maybe the Civil War never would have
better.
Happened.
Exactly. And I think that the truth is, there is no clean answer to that question, but it's certainly an interesting question and a worthwhile debate.
It's really fascinating to just look at the formation of America and see when you have Plymouth Rock and you have Jamestown, that's where the issue started, is these two separate colonies growing in the North and the South, and that everything goes back to those initial seeds of colonization. It's just crazy to see the journey that the country goes on from there. The reason that I think that Stanton was pushing so much in Lincoln towards that issue is that, for me, the most influential book for me was the Frank Abiel Flower book, The Autocrat of Rebellion, Emancipation, and Reconstruction. And in that, he very clearly lays out the things that Stanton pushed for and the things that Lincoln made him take back. And it could be exactly what Steve was saying. It was Lincoln being pragmatic and being incremental rather than trying to push it too much.
And Stanton being stubborn.
And Stanton
and
being
impatient.
Stubborn. But it's the book very clearly lays out all of the steps that were taken forward and backward in that struggle between those two men and what the policy ended up being with Emancipation Proclamation.
But I think it's undeniable that Edwin Stanton's actions had an indelible impact on Abraham Lincoln, but equally impactful to John Wilkes Booth. I mean, Booth followed the political climate of the day. He followed in the press the actions of Edwin Stanton and of Lincoln's administration. And certainly, just as he was moving Lincoln ever so slowly towards, you know, the goal that he wished for, which was equality and emancipation, at the very same time, he was alienating John Wilkes Booth and, you know, pushing him towards his monstrous, horrific, inevitable end. Not to say that it's Edwin Stanton's fault, but certainly from John Wilkes Booth's perspective, he definitely would have pointed a finger of blame at Edwin Stanton.
The truth is, Lincoln by far had the most progress of any president before him, and did take those final steps to say we should have black suffrage and that all those soldiers that risked their lives should have the right to vote. And that was a step far beyond any president that had been before him.
And it's what killed him. but it's also what cemented his place in the annals of history. And it's the reason why he was considered and is considered one of the greatest presidents of all time.
The fact that these issues still resonate so loudly today is in part because of the price that he paid to bring that issue front and center that we're still dealing with today.
And I oftentimes imagine and wonder what it might have been like had Lincoln survived, had Lincoln been able to live through Reconstruction, and how our country might have been different. You know, what would the next chapter for Abraham Lincoln be? It's one of those mysteries we'll never know.
Well, it's interesting that you would mention that, because we actually put out the word on Twitter that we were doing this final recording. And if anyone had specific questions, they should send them in. And Michael Moore, I think not the world famous documentarian, but a listener asked what your opinion was of what Reconstruction would have looked like had Lincoln survived. Interesting also, I think, about that question that, like, if Stanton had allowed Eckert to go with him to the fort, like, so many questions that left unanswered. But where do you guys fall on how things might have looked? Or do you avoid that?
Well, I think it's, again, it's a mystery. We'll never know. We can only conjecture. I have to believe that Lincoln would have prosecuted Reconstruction in a way that would have built a larger consensus than Andrew Johnson. I don't think that's a controversial statement. But I think the real question is on the spectrum of leniency to punishment, where would Lincoln have fallen? And I don't know. I don't know that my mind is made up about that. I think a compelling argument can be made either way.
I think that the radicals in Congress could have pushed him more towards their side of things earlier on than Johnson, they allowed Johnson to, because Johnson was able to veto them. Obviously, they were able to override. But I think that they would have been able to convince him to move a little bit to the argument of punishment for the South. We've talked before about the threshold that they had to have of people who would take the oath to come back into the country.
Percentage of each population of every state had to swear this loyalty oath before they would be fully readmitted into the Union.
And Johnson, when he did it, it was 10%. 10% of people had to say sorry for treason, and then their state would be back in.
And the radical Republicans wanted it to be closer to 50%. And then, of course, there were folks, Democrats primarily, who wanted it to be 0%. That's ultimately the way that Andrew Johnson moved.
Right.
But that's sort of on that spectrum, where would Lincoln have fallen? I mean, what do you think?
And as I said, I think that they would have been able to convince Lincoln to make the threshold higher. They probably would have definitely pushed to not allow ex-Confederate generals or leadership to reassume positions in Congress, which I think is just a travesty that was allowed, especially since this was the bloodiest war our country had ever seen.
Well, and it's one of the things that fascinates me so much about the stories that you guys have found, and how little pieces of it have huge effects. Like, if the tribunal doesn't happen, Mary Surratt is not hung, which was a point that swung huge opinion into so many little things in terms of, like, okay, Johnny Surratt is in the wind because he's being hunted for this, but he was a key factor in proving it. And if he hadn't fled and was brought into trial, they might have been able to prove the conspiracy. There's so many different pieces, and I think you guys have done a great job of finding these little things in history that I didn't know had the ability to affect things in the way that they did. All right, so some other listener questions. Betsy from Dallas has asked a question about specifically what happened to the character of Lucy. You talk about differing consequences. You know, Mary Surratt's consequences were very grave, and Lucy was not prosecuted. What happened to Lucy after the story?
Lucy went to Spain with her father. They were there for 5 years, I believe.
He got very sick in 1870.
And had to return to the United States, and she ultimately went with him. While she was overseas, though, she was still sort of the belle of Washington. She was the belle of Europe. She was courted by the high society in Europe, everywhere she went, including by many of her former suitors that predated Robert Lincoln and John Wilkes Booth. She ultimately married one of those suitors.
And became the Navy Secretary.
Yeah, that's right.
Really?
And they had a child together. Yeah, so she stayed in her... I mean, I think John Parker would have been very proud of her. I don't know that squares with the Lucy that we've created in the fiction of it all.
Right.
But certainly, yeah, she married a statesman, a politician, and a highborn man.
And in the end was so loyal to her father that she built him a monument when he died.
All right, there's a few others that I was interested in checking in on. What happened to Robert Lincoln? I mean, he clearly did not become the world-changing politician What happened to Robert?
Robert actually did end up having a bit of a political career. He ended up becoming the Secretary of War for a future president. Robert was on the train with Garfield when he was shot, and then Garfield died 2 months later. He was on a train to go see McKinley when McKinley was shot and assassinated.
And so I can't remember which president, maybe it was Taft. It was somebody later had invited him, and he said, I'm not going to spend time around any other presidents.
No,
I'm
thank you.
Luck.
There's another, well, it's not as crazy as that story. I mean, that's an incredible fact. But one of the other crazy stories about Robert, this actually predates the action of this play, but while he was a student, I think he was a student at Harvard, he was traveling from, I think, New York to DC. He was standing on a train platform. It was incredibly crowded. He was backing up to try to move out of the way, and he slipped and he fell. And he fell in between the train and the edge of the platform. And the train started to move, and Robert would have been crushed by this train. And a man reached down, grabbed Robert Lincoln, and pulled him up and saved his life. And when Robert Lincoln turned around, who was standing there? None other than
Edwin Booth.
That's right.
Edwin Booth saved Robert Lincoln's life.
And Robert knew who Edwin was because everyone knew who Edwin was. Edwin had no idea. And then months later, Lincoln wrote a letter to Edwin Booth thanking him for saving his son's life.
Wow.
And there's a weird connection. There's a man named Adam Boudreau who was the man that Robert ended up serving under at the end of the war just as his secretary because he wasn't allowed on the battlefield. He was a close friend of Edwin Booth's and actually stayed in Edwin Booth's home when there was a riot in New York. He was injured and stayed with them. And he's the one that vouched for Edwin Booth when the assassination investigation was going on, that he is an American, he is a patriot, he would never be tied to John Wilkes Booth and what he did. And a lot of people have said that his saving of Robert is what saved him later in that investigation.
Well, and what happened, let's talk a little bit about the future of Edwin after this story. Of course, the family is besmirched in a huge way.
He gave up acting for a while and was just, they felt like the family name was disgraced. Took him a while to get back into it, but the country did eventually forgive Edwin. And he performed for many presidents after that and still continued to be a respected member of society.
Okay, so additional recap. What was the follow-up on some of the other conspirators that we met in these bonus episodes?
Well, of course, we know that four of the conspirators, of which there were many, were hung. It was Mary Surratt, David Harold, Lewis Payne Powell.
And George Atzerodt.
But our composite character, Samuel O'Loughlin, who is Samuel Arnold, Michael O'Loughlin.
And Samuel Mudd and Ned Spangler, who we never talked about. He was the guy at the theater that was arrested. They were all sent to Dry Tortuga. There was a outbreak of, I think it was scarlet fever, and lots of them died. And Samuel Mudd actually ended up volunteering for the prison to help.
Because he's a doctor, right?
Because he's a doctor to try to help. And, I mean, Michael O'Loughlin died of that in prison. Samuel was later given a pardon by Johnson because of his efforts in the prison and ended up living out a life in a farm and had Ned Spangler working for him personally on the farm because I guess he couldn't get a job anywhere else.
And then
it's really weird.
I think we mentioned this already, but John Surratt was, of course, ended up in Rome. He was a papal guard.
Right, we talked about him being a papal guard
ultimately,
and then coming back and doing a speaker circuit.
Right, which is also bizarre.
Very bizarre.
And in that speaker circuit, he says that he met with the Secretary of War of the Confederacy within the week that Lincoln was killed. But he says, oh, but I didn't have anything to do with it. But I sort of feel like when you read his words, it's sort of like nudge, nudge, wink, wink, yes, I did.
And then closing out finally with Booth, he was buried in an unmarked grave under the floor of a government building until he was finally, the family was like begging for his body to be exhumed and to bury him elsewhere.
I'm amazed that they let that happen, actually.
It took a long time, yeah. And Edwin was begging for that body back, which is one of the reasons why I wholeheartedly shoot down the escape theory that people have that Booth ended up escaping down to Texas.
I think you should say what it is because I don't think people know
the people that don't know, there is an escape theory. Tell us about what
that was. That he survived the barn, that he escaped down to...
Well, there's a story that he was at the Granberry Opera
Granberry,
House.
Granberry, that's what it was.
Yeah.
And that he was performing down here and...
Granberry is a small town in Texas where there is a lovely opera house where these days they do a lot of summer musicals and things of that nature. But that's the theory, is that Booth was there working until he died.
And then he died and then a guy bought the body and toured around with the body at fairs showing the body and saying it was John Wilkes Booth. I think it's preposterous because the family fought so hard for his body, and they had a really extensive autopsy done when he was first shot, and they had another autopsy done when they reclaimed the body
when
to make sure
exhumed.
that was him, because the family had fought so hard to get his body back. And I don't think they would have accepted anything less than getting their actual loved one back at that time.
Yeah, I agree.
Clearly, every question I throw at you guys, you have a treasure trove of facts and research that you have done. So much information in both of these very tired skulls that I see before me. But one of the questions that we also got from at Fashion and Faith, who has been a listener of the show for a long time and a big fan, wanted to know, is there any specific resources if they wanted to find out more about specifically Edwin Stanton?
The book that I mentioned before was by Frank A. Flower, Edwin McMaster Stanton, The Autocrat of Rebellion, Emancipation, and Reconstruction.
That it just flows off the tongue. Yes, it just flows off the tongue.
That was really a great book because he actually interviewed people that knew Stanton and they had personal stories. A lot of the personal stories we had came from that, talking about the poisoning, drinking the poison in the trial and the crashing into the bridge
riverboat
story. A lot of those stories came from that book because he did interview people that knew Stanton in his lifetime. The other one that was really helpful was George Congdon Gorham's Life and Public Services of Edwin M. Stanton. Very dry and boring for anybody that would probably want to read it, but it was great for me because it had so much of a wealth of information.
And if you like dry and boring, I think we've mentioned it before, but Gideon Wells' diary is lovely. I mean, I think it's a page turner. But the book that I out of all the Stanton books that I've read, and I've read a lot, Eric has read way more than me. But the one that I really love is Walter Starr's Lincoln's War Secretary, which is, I think, the most recent of the books, which means that I read it very, very, very late in this process. I actually started reading that book after the show was already locked and in the can. And it's one of those that I wish I had had a hold of earlier in the process. And I hope one day I get to meet Walter Starr because I would love to pick his brain.
Is that the one that talks about Charles Dickens?
Yes. Yes.
Tell them about that, because I think that's fascinating.
Well, Charles Dickens sort of did a tour of the Americas and, you know, spent some time in, you know, Washington City and actually had dinner with a lot of prominent statesmen at that time. But one of them was Edwin Stanton. And they talked a lot about his relationship to Abraham Lincoln. I kind of got the vibe from what I've read about that meeting between Dickens and Stanton that Dickens sort of thought that Stanton just loved him. Stanton definitely loved Charles Dickens, though. He was a huge Charles Dickens fan. He could quote Dickens by memory to the extent that Dickens even remarked that Stanton would quote passages from his books that he did not even recollect were his own.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And that was one of those things that I was like, oh, I wish I had known that when I first started conceiving of Stanton as a character, because I would have, instead of like going to Shakespeare and the Greeks and, you know, Aristotle, I would have gone more Dickensian with it. It's interesting.
Well, before we finish up, I want to do some wrap up and ask a few questions, not about the content, but the process of creating this podcast. And to do that, I want to invite executive producer and sound engineer and composer and the man in charge of everything, Lindsey Graham, the host of American History Tellers, host of American Scandal, creator of Terms, and the man who did all of the music, all of the sound design, way more work than he ever thought it was going to be on these 15 episodes. So welcome
Thank
to the booth
you. I knew
again.
Exactly how much work it was.
You took it so stoically, too. You just knew it was coming.
Yeah, I wanted to do it.
So this has been a long journey, as we've mentioned, for all of us. Longer, of course, for you, Steve and Eric. But Lindsey and I have been now on this for a year and a half. Some of these were recorded over a year ago. Some of the performances, some of them were recorded remotely in New York and in studios and other places and kind of put together. But I wanted to take all three of you back to the very beginning of when we started. One of the questions we got from listener Betsy also was like, what was it like the first time you heard Jeremy Schwartz doing the voice of Stanton? Because I know for me, that was the moment when I'm like, oh yeah, this is going to work. For me, this was that moment. I was going to ask what that moment was like for you guys and if there were other key moments that stood out in the recording process that you realized like, oh, this is going to be special.
Well, I remember personally the first time that I even heard mentioned that you and Steve had talked about this project was we were at Rob's house for Christmas caroling And you'd like mentioned in the kitchen, hey, I don't know if you heard our podcast terms, which I did, and it's incredible. You should listen to it.
Download it now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
None of this would have been possible without the success of Terms, and so definitely need to check that show out. But that was the first time I heard mention that you guys were talking about turning this into a podcast, and I was totally on board.
Yeah, and certainly the first time that I heard Jeremy read those words, it just all made sense to me. But another key moment was a moment where Lindsay took a speech. I believe it was the speech at the end of scene two. We were in the studio. Jeremy was doing the speech live, and Lindsay began to play a riff on his guitar as we were recording Jeremy. And it was beautiful. And I was like, what are you doing? But I didn't want to say anything. And Lindsay was composing what I think was the very kernel of what would become our theme.
Yeah, I'd been kicking it around. I have to mention, you know, Jeremy came to us third or fourth or fifth in line of people we had, you know, zeroed in on who to be.
We tried a lot of folks to try to find the exact right balance.
And they were all exceptional actors. And it was, I don't know, I just wasn't satisfied until Jeremy sat down in front of the microphone and commanded it. He had a presence, a gravitas, an importance, a severity. He was Edwin Stanton from the first syllable. And I think this project owes him a great debt.
Absolutely.
I agree.
We tried a lot of wedding dresses, but he was the one that just...
We had to say yes to that dress.
It was the one. You knew it the second you tried it.
Other moments in the recording process that stood out for you? For me, there was some times when we had like four characters together in a room and going back and forth. Really, there was some Wells, Johnson, Stanton, Seward, that were some great stuff early on that I really, really moved and had some energy to it.
I think the first time we heard our Bruce Elliott and Jeremy Schwartz together,
yeah,
it was amazing.
And
the two of them.
Our Bruce Elliott is the actor who plays Andrew Johnson, of course, and he is absolutely incredible. I also think let's put it this way. Lindsay and I could do a scene together. He could be in Dallas. I could be in London. We could cut the scene together. Lindsay would design it. He would soundscape it. And the audience would be none the wiser. And that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some nuances that occur when you have the actors in the room together, organically experiencing what it's like to look each other in the eyes and have an experience in that moment. And that organic thing, we were able to capture that quite a bit. Luckily, we were gifted with the blessing of being able to put these brilliant actors in the room together. And oftentimes, some of the best moments in the show were accidents. They were stumbles. They were hiccups. They were lines that weren't even on the page. They misspoke. And those happy accidents gave it a sort of, I believe, a very organic, realistic quality at times. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about working in audio drama is that, you know, you're kind of doing a play, but only for yourselves. Nobody's watching. You know, Lindsay's listening. You're listening, Rob, as the director, and maybe I'm listening and Eric's listening. But it's really just an audience of the number of people that are in the room. And I think we're blessed with some very, very gifted actors.
Yeah, we got some great performances.
I think on a side note, the second bonus episode is probably the most people that weren't in the same room together. The most that the scenes were mixed with people from out of town. Monty was never in the room in that episode. Derek Phillips was out of the room. Reed Burney was out of the room. A lot of those people were recorded at different times. But again, the talent of our actors and being able to find those nuances, even when you're talking to no one or talking to Steve in the other room on a microphone.
Well, and again, credit to Lindsey Graham of putting those people in the same physical space and making it really imperceptible that they are not
masterful.
Just staring at each other. Yeah, it's masterful. There was a couple times when I even forgot, oh, that's right, they weren't there. I'd listen back to the scene and try to remember it, and it wasn't until later that I realized, like, oh, they weren't even in the room. That was recorded 2 months later in a different studio in somebody's closet somewhere or whatever. So kudos to you,
yeah, Lindsay. The biggest compliment that I heard about the show, and I think this speaks to Lindsay, to your work, was it wasn't that I could hear it. It was I can see it. I'm listening to it, and I can see it. And I thought that was really high praise.
So you have been involved. You're the most experienced of all the podcasters in the room, Lindsay. What are your thoughts on audio drama now? You've been doing dramatized history, straight history, true crime, different areas of the world. This and Terms are the two fully dramatized things. Are you a fan? It's an awful lot of work.
Am I a fan of the work that I myself do? Yes. I am quite fond of what I accomplish. Audio drama as a niche is an interesting one. I mean, first of all, the podcast industry is moving quickly and changing, you know, abruptly and in large measures. There's also all of a sudden hundreds of millions of dollars involved and major power players. It's shifting. Audio drama is not really a part of that landscape. And the reason why is because I don't know. It should be. The audiences just haven't been there, except for, you know, star-studded blockbusters that just happen to. I mean, if you're Gimlet and you come out with a Catherine Keener, David Schwimmer, Homecoming, and get Apple to be a sponsor on it, it's going to succeed. I mean, there's certain formulas just to the business that make some projects more viable than the others. I desperately wish that wasn't the case, because I think we would see an audio drama community and industry that wasn't as contained to fantasy, sci-fi, horror as it is. We would see more political or historical explorations in the space. There's no reason that any story shouldn't be able to be told through audio. The only thing I can think of is, like, car chases would probably be bad. You know,
Oh, I think we could make that really interesting, actually. I've wanted to do a car chase for a while.
But you know, like a French Connection 20-minute car chase just doesn't seem like it's good for audio. But accepting that, there really is not a story that shouldn't be able to be told in audio. And what that does is democratize the medium. And I hope that by democratizing it, meaning that it's cheaper to produce, it's easier for ordinary average folks to do something on a scale that they didn't think they had. The idea that you know, we've all seen low-rent short films being made. We've made them ourselves. And there are sacrifices you have to make. Here, really, if you have 8 square feet in a closet and a $150 microphone, you're on your way. And that won't get you a lens, let alone a camera and an editor and a location in the film world.
Yeah. And then it's easy. You just need great writing and amazing actors. And those are a dime a dozen, right, yeah. Steve? Those are everywhere. I will say we got really lucky with this script. This was amazing to have this much a pool of a resource. A lot of people ask us, you know, what's next? What are you guys going to do next? We don't know. We don't have an answer for that. I will say that there is no other project that Steve and Eric have been working on for the past 17 years that they're ready for.
We have a short list of things that we're interested in.
But there are things coming up. Also, you mentioned, Homecoming. If someone wants to make a feature film, please call us, 1865 website, the podcast, Facebook, Twitter. Reach out to us if you have several million dollars and would like to see the screen adaptation of this. We are more than interested in talking. Steve's a big time Hollywood screenwriter, so that's going to be, you know,
easy. So big time, only to my mother. No, but I have something to say about just what the process is like. One of the things about writing, first of all, writing for radio is counterintuitive. It's not the way that I was brought up as a storyteller, trained as a storyteller, educated as a storyteller. I would say it's probably true of everybody in this room. For the most part, we learned using our eyes, right? Whether it was reading words on a page or whether it was watching moving images on a screen, the first place that we experienced story was not with our ears, it was with our eyes. And I think that, you know, that's a relatively new thing in the grand scope of technology. And one of the challenges for me in approaching something as big and sweeping and epic as this without the benefit of visual storytelling, which is something that I realized I rely pretty heavily upon, is just how to do it in a way that just isn't bad. I mean, because it's like Lindsay was talking about the car chase earlier. The only surefire way to pull off a car chase is to have an actor say, "Wow, that was a crazy car chase, wasn't it? Can you believe that car chase? Wow, that car chase.
Did you see the way he went left?
And actually,
then he
would
went
be
right
like
really fast.
Actually, it would be like, Mr. McCollum, that was a crazy car chase. And then you would say,
yes, Daryl.
Or to do a found footage where it's tonight on the nightly news, the car chase through downtown Dallas. Yeah. And
but those constraints, they sort of force you to be creative. And one of the blessings that I think we had during this process was the ability to be nimble. You know, we're basically a four-person team with an amazing cast. And we discovered things. And actually, the play that is sort of an offshoot of this podcast, it's called Mars. And it's still evolving. It's still in development with the Dallas Theater Center. And as that play evolved and as that play changed, and as I learned more about the story, the podcast would shapeshift, you know? And that's something that you don't get with film, you know? You don't always have the ability to go back and take another little nuanced stab at a scene or adjust something or manipulate something. A lot of the times, once it's locked, it's locked. That's the end of the day. So it was very much a learning process for me, and one that I was really grateful to go through.
Well, and it was fascinating because there were changes being made right up until last week, much to Lindsey Graham's chagrin. But changes.
I forced many of those changes.
Some of those were your own.
I cut the crap out of these things. Dialogue has changed. Entire sentences have, you know, been reordered, all in the editing process. And I can't tell you what the impetus is other than it just sounds better that way.
Well, and I think we've also learned a lot as listeners. You know, we started listening to this, you know, 15 weeks ago. And, you know, even though we've been involved in the edit, to then like sit in your car or sit, you know, in your house and with your earbuds in and listen to it as a audience member, and realize like, oh, they're going to get it. We don't need all that. Mm-hmm. We can cut four sentences out of that scene because that one sentence says it and the audience is with us. They know who these people are. Well, the voices are so distinct. The characters are so distinct.
And it's just like film. There's the film you write, there's the film you shoot, and there's the film you edit. And I think if you approached audio drama with a playwright sensibility, you would not have a great deal of success. I think you have to approach audio drama from a sort of global storyteller perspective, because if you try to come in rigid with it, it just won't play. There's the audio drama you write, there's the one you record, and then there's the one that you cut.
All right, guys, I think that is all that there is to be said for this final Inside the Episode of 1865, the podcast. Lindsey Graham, Eric Archilla, Stephen Walters.
Robert McCollum, director extraordinaire. Thank you, sir.
It has been an amazing journey to all of you listening. Thank you for going with us on this journey, both for the podcast itself and this Inside the Episode look on how we did it. I hope it was as interesting to you as it was entertaining for us to put this whole thing together. Guys, raise a glass to 1865.
Can we at least have Lindsay add a little clink, like a proper clink?
No,
at
I
the
think
end?
It's these bad beer cans that need to be. It needs to be exactly that.
Lindsay, make it sound like champagne, please. Just please.
Okay. We're leaving that all in.
I think that we should.
All of that is staying in.